Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sport administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
Thanks, Colleen. In this episode, we look at the business of women's football. And here to discuss it is Karen Madden, TV presenter and host of the Girl Sports Club on Hits 92 FM. Karen, welcome.
It's my pleasure.
You're back from France. How was that experience at the Women's World Cup?
It was amazing, actually. Obviously, you know, I was working and it was hard work.
Really?
It was. It really was. I keep getting that reaction, you know, because people think, oh, you're in an exotic country. You're not. But it really was hard work. It was grueling stuff. We had deadlines and the time difference between us and Jamaica, that is, and France made it even harder. But it was an amazing experience, and especially for someone who has covered women's football. It was just amazing to be there in the same space. I actually cried when the Reggae Girls walked out in their first game. You know, it was just amazing. It was incredible. And it was awesome to see so many Jamaicans coming, you know, supporting the team, journeying with the team. That's great.
Awesome. Okay, so we're going to get into that a little bit more, but I wanted to ask you up front. So you're a mother, you're a fan of the sport, you're a lecturer, you're a journalist, sadly a Chelsea fan. How does these help to shape the Karen we know now?
I think all of those pieces join so perfectly. In fact, my interest in football started, women's football started with my daughter. Because, of course, you know the story. My daughter started playing football at Ardennes and then got a scholarship to the UWI under then director of sports, one Dalton Myers, to play football there. And so because I love sports from before and I was interested in my daughter's journey, I would go to the games. I've been watching football since she was in high school, you know. So seeing people like Bonnie Shaw and Trudy Carter, seeing them now as professional footballers, that's amazing too, because I saw them when they were playing in high school. So that is how it started. And then when I switched my journey from being a news reporter to a sports reporter, then head of sports Patrick Anderson said, okay, so obviously you're a woman, but I'm not employing you to write women's sports or to cover women's sports. I do expect you though to use that bias, because sometimes you use the word bias in a bad way, but it's not a bad thing, to use that to ensure that women's sports are covered, you know. And so I did that, you know, and because of that, you know, it wasn't just netball. I really, really felt passionately about women's football in particular and the attention or lack thereof that it gets. And of course, that spread to the wider issue of women in sports as well, because as you know, most sports in Jamaica that are predominantly done by women get the support is not commensurate with what the men get.
How difficult was that transition from what we consider hardcore news journalism to sports journalism, and was that a scary period to make that decision for you?
It was scary because sports journalism is a male-dominated area, and so that was difficult. And it was not like I was immersed in sports either. I didn't, I probably should not say this publicly, but it wasn't like I was a national, you know, player or anything like that. You know, most people who come into sports journalism actually competed, you know, whether at the school level or at the national level, so they were more immersed in it. People here in Karen Madden Udat, you know, they've never heard this person, but she know about sport kind of thing. And because over the world you have these wonderful female sports journalists, but again, most of them come into it having participated themselves or competed themselves. Otherwise, you're just on pretty face where somebody won't put a mic in your hand, you know, and I didn't want that. I wanted to be taken seriously, so it meant that I had to work harder. And I tell students who I talk to now, women, that it maybe is unfair, but you actually have to work harder than the men, because that's the only way you're going to be taken seriously. People expect that every time you open your mouth to talk sport as a woman, you don't know what you're talking about, or they are not listening to what you're saying. So you have to ensure that what is coming out of your mouth is credible.
That's true. One of the things though, since you started out in media, I wanted to ask, how has the landscape changed you know, you're making that transition, what are some of the changes that you observe compared to when you just started to know?
Well, I think the probably biggest is the emergence and now almost the establishment of social media. Yeah, I think that changes the competition. It changes the landscape. It changes everything. I remember when South African para athlete whose name is escaping me right now, when he was when he was arrested for allegedly killing his then girlfriend, the first place I saw it was on Twitter. You know, I was whoa. And it was actually the BBC that had tweeted it. So those kinds of changes, I think that that's a major change that has come about as a result of during my journey. Right. You look now, for instance, FIFA women's football going on now, and you can actually follow everything, not just by watching it. Somebody's blogging, you can pick up a stat. I can go on FIFA's website and know the stats of the game, know how much corner kick take, those kinds of things. So I think technology and the impact thereof is one of the biggest changes that I've seen.
We're going to get to that. Talk to us about that day that you were told that, hey, listen, you're scheduled to be a TV presenter for a particular. This is going to be your first one doing sports news. Talk
Who's
us
that?
About that and how that felt.
So what had happened was I was first scheduled to present on radio, right? So I remember going up to the roster one day and seeing that Patrick Anderson had rostered me to present radio. I mean, that's one I see it. And I hid it out until I finally called. I was like, it's kind of not presenting. So then Jordan Fort and I, my colleague, we started doing TV training at the same time.
Okay.
So it's all right, fine. We're doing training and everything, but we don't expect to be rostered. And certainly, I didn't expect it, but he is good. He's a natural. So I expected him to go on. But I didn't expect to go on anytime soon. And then Patrick kept saying, you guys, please read the roster because you never know when I'm going. And then I went up there one day and see that he had put me down to present the Sunday coming up. And I started shaking. I was like, no. Lord Jesus. Because actually, being in media, I'd been in media for many years and I don't read and I like radio. I like the anonymity of radio. I don't like, now I have to get accustomed to wherever I go, people recognize, or at least one person recognize me. So I liked that, you know?
Right.
So this is probably about Monday or Tuesday, he posted the rosters and there's my name to present on the Sunday afternoon. Oh my goodness. So Sunday came, and the Sunday desk is usually about 3 or 4 of us that work the Sunday desk. It's a shorter bulletin by comparison to the other weeks, but trust me, those 15 minutes felt like 35 minutes. Felt long. Felt like, oh my, what am I doing? What am I? Because there is, I tell people that with TV, there are people talking in your ear, and you have to maintain your composure. So is that going on? You're maintaining your composure. Something will go wrong. The prompter gone. About it business and these kinds of things. So, but I wrote it out, and I have really, really amazing colleagues. You know, really, really amazing. They'll tell you if you're the foolishness. They will help. They'll not just leave it with the foolishness. They'll help you, including the production people, including the cameramen, including the directors and the producers inside our control room. They will help you. You know, there was. I can't breathe and slow down. You go too fast, kind of thing, you know? And it's, I think I've grown, and I think I listen to the telling, you know, I take the criticism. I have people like Leonie Forbes, a wonderful woman, who will call me and say, Karen, good presentation, but you said X, and you know, but she's so wonderful. She's right. Amazing, you know? And I will call her and say, oh, I'm about to read, how do you say, is it debacle or debacle? You know, I am not afraid to ask questions, and I tell people that I talk to, ask questions. I better you ask and get the correction rather than make a fool of yourself. So that's what it's been like.
Do you find that, especially because of social media, etc., that there is more criticism? You pick up more criticism now that you're on TV. People send you messages on social media or wherever, you know, drop criticism of whatever you have done. Do you find that happening more now, you know, than before?
It does. It happens more now. And I don't, as I said before, I don't have an issue with criticism. Criticism has helped me to grow in my career. What I hate and what I take offense to is unkindness. And there's a lot of unkindness in social media. There are people who, especially those people with no profile pics, or they're using random names like, you know, and aliases. They are the ones who have the most unkind things to say about people. So that is what I have an issue with. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't have a problem. Pick up the phone, call me, text me, send me a direct message, whatever. Or even if you want to criticize me in the open space, that's okay. But when people are unkind, that is what I have an issue with.
So you have presented, you have been doing a good job there. Then you have your own show, The Girl Sports Club. You co-host with Trishana McGowan. Talk to us a bit about that show and how it has evolved.
That came again. That was another brainchild of Patrick Anderson. You know, he said that, you know, he wanted to do that. You know, we hadn't in Jamaica had a radio talk show, sports, you know, hosted by two women, and he wanted to do that. He took a big gamble because at the time, Trishana was just coming into that level of work, you know, broadcasting full time. And I had only just started, you know, probably about a year or two into my own journey as a sports journalist. So he took a huge gamble, but he felt that we could do it. And because of our personalities, it has grown. You know, we are not afraid, again, if somebody calls and says, what is XYZ, and we're not afraid to say we don't know, or we're not afraid to say Daniel or Jerome or producers look up that for me, we don't know about that kind of thing. You know, personalities allow us, and I think the program started as a 1 hour and 45 minute program. It is now a 1 hour program. Budgetary constraints and all of that, you know, stations change their business models and all of that. But I think we have grown, and I think that we have a staple set of listeners, you know, who are there. We know the people who listen and probably won't call, or they hit you up on social media, or you'll be walking on the road or go to a sporting event and they may say, hey, me listen to the show, you know, or they repeat something that you said in the show. Yeah. Things I never hear when you said Liverpool or Idiot side kind of thing.
Yeah, that's unfortunate if you ever said that.
and then of course there are those who call, you know, and they challenge us, and we are not afraid. We feel no editorial pressures in terms of, once we follow journalistic ethics, we feel no editorial pressures as to what we can say and or cannot say.
Okay, so now we go back to the football itself. You have been covering, you've been following the women's football program, especially because your daughter plays. We started at onset that you support Chelsea Football Club.
Wonderful club.
Which I think is unfortunate.
It's wonderful.
Talk to us, or just explain some of the issues that you have observed with the women's program, just in general in Jamaica.
It does not get the support that it deserves. It does not get the support commensurate with the number of girls and women that football has helped. I mean, when you look across the landscape, the number of girls that have got scholarships to universities, as I said before, my daughter included, the amount of girls that have got scholarships to overseas universities, hundreds probably, I'm sure it has gone into thousands now of women and girls that have got scholarships. It doesn't get that kind of support that shows how much of a gateway, you know. Look at a person like a Khadija Shaw. We like to talk about her at the global stage where she is now a reggae girl and now a professional footballer, but Khadija Shaw is some Spanish town Jamaica, a depressed community, you know. And when you look across the entire Jamaica, football can change the lives of so many women. So many women have got professional contracts as a result of playing football, you know. I talked to Trudy Carter, another reggae girl, and she's like, she's still pinching herself that she's being paid to play something that she loves doing, you know. So I think it is extremely unfair. I mean, I see a number of sponsors coming on board as a result of the reggae girls making it to the World Cup stage, and that's great. You know, it's always great to welcome new sponsors on board, but I think more and more boardrooms need to recognize that at the national level, that's the finished product. We need a grassroots program. We need girls to be able to start playing football from they are 4 and 5 years old, so they get comfortable and intimate with touching a ball. When you look at the top teams, the top countries in the world, that the United States, for instance, those countries, those girls start playing football from them can walk good. And it shows. And those countries, even whether it is by legal edict or not, they pump money into their programs. And yes, you can argue that, you know, it's chalk and cheese, them have more money than us, and so on, so they win the economic battle. But at the same time, I think that where's our will, there's a way, and I think that we waste money on a lot of other things that we could be investing into, a thing like football. And I also think that the private sector needs to come on board in terms of ensuring that we have a national league. It is most critical to us being able to challenge again for another spot in the next World Cup. We have to have a national league that is competitive and that lasts for at least 6 months. That is the recommendation from our national coach.
And part of the challenge then is one, we're still in a space where people don't believe that girls should be playing football, well, sports, and then football. So that's the first one. And the second issue is that of cost, isn't it? Where a lot of the clubs are saying, well, here's what, even if you have the league, we can't fund it because we're not too sure if we're going to get return on investment. How do you think we can treat those then?
All right, so yes, we're fighting against cultural norms and stereotypes and whatnot about what women should or shouldn't do. So there's that. But I think that if we listen to the stories that are told by all the players now that we celebrated when they reached the World Cup, if you listen to every single one of those players, including those girls that didn't grow up in Jamaica, one thing is common about every interview I've done with every one of those 23 players that went to the World Cup. They started playing football because their parents believed that they should go and play. They said, "Mommy, Daddy, I want to play football." And they said, "Yeah, sure. Just come in." I remember Jody Brown saying, our parents said to her, our mommy said to her, "Just come in before night come down. Right. And you're good." You know, so first of all, parents have to believe in the dreams of their children. If that is what your child wants to do, as long as there's something safe, as long as the child is safe, then you should do that. Then we need the educators, the ISA of this life, to believe in it as well. Because in fairness to ISA, the schoolgirls program is consecutive. Mm-hmm. It keeps up. You know, it's consistent. So let's put some money in that. Everybody wants to line up behind Manning and the Costa Cup. Just give the girl them some of the money. Give them some of the love. Give them some of the attention so that all the girls who want to play will be able to play. And then move it up again now to the national level. So if the girls that come out of high school and probably don't get a university scholarship or not able to, they have a league to play, you know? So I think I think it requires a will and probably a change in perception. And probably, I'm not going to lie, the sport probably needs some cleaning up and some, but I think that it will come when people start to take pride in what they do. Because if you, for instance, going to be playing a league that lasts 6 weeks. You don't take training seriously.
Right.
You know?
It's 6 weeks.
It's 6 weeks. We can't just run up and down. We don't need to train for that. Also, the girls are not paid. Mm-hmm. So that's a big problem because there are girls and women who literally can't find the bus fare for go to training. You know, and if the clubs won't have the money until JFF give them the money, you know, right. So it's a catch-22 situation. So I think it generally requires, you see, this high that we're on from the reggae girls qualification, great, one wonderful qualification to the World Cup. I think that Jamaica Football Federation needs to ride on that bounce and needs to I don't know if them need a new marketing strategy in order to draw in more sponsors, because as a now, we still don't know when the next league going to start.
You mean the league for 2019?
The league for 2019.
Which is what we're saying is crucial, isn't
which
it?
Which is what we're saying is crucial in order for us to make it, because this hodgepodge thing can't work. We're just going and find some girls where them parents are born in Jamaica. That's not a program. That's not a developmental program. So what we need is a program with 1, 2, 3 steps. You know? So I think, as I said, whether it is that the JFF needs to change its marketing strategy and approach different companies, I don't know what it is they need to do. Whether it is they need to say to the sponsors of the Red Stripe Premier League that, hey, why don't you spend some of the money over here? Whether it is, as I think should be done, that the PLCA should also take on women's football, because at least that's a program and a strategy and people are focused on it. So I believe strongly that two things I think should happen with leagues. I believe that the schoolgirl league should be twinned with Manning and the Costa Cup. I think the girls should play as curtain raisers. And I think also that the national women's program should be under the auspices of the PLCA.
Fair enough. Those are two good recommendations. Let me ask you though, do you think that locally we are seeing more people willing to push their girls or, you know, persons who they have care of to participate in football? Do you think this is changing the dynamic, or certainly us going to the World Cup? What are you seeing as a mother, as a fan, as a journalist?
I think, again, the reggae girls going to the World Cup was huge. There are people who had never heard of Khadija Sharp. People think, oh, she's born and graduated. Yeah, man, she's someone called San Diego, really? People had never heard about Trudy Carter. People had not heard. So I think when little girls, and I've been around the team and seen them mentor young girls and seeing little girls at the primary school girls who look up to these ladies as role models and say, hey, maybe if Bonnie Shaw do that, me must can do that too. I think that has created a bounce, and I think that you will have, just in the case when we had Usain Bolt, everybody wanted to run. I think that with Jamaica qualifying for the World Cup and people watching the World Cup, especially even though the reggae girls are out of the World Cup now, the interest is there. There are people my social media page is going, at first me and watch World Cup, you know, Women's World Cup, and I've never watched it before. There are people saying, what them girl I can't play, you know. People are actually, as a matter of fact, there was a huge laughter in my department this week when some of the men were saying that the Women's World Cup right now are the best ball game I'm playing right now, given the fact that Copa and Gold Cup going on, you know. So I think that gives us an opportunity to show what we can accomplish, but it's not going to happen by the snap of a finger.
So you went to France, you covered, and you're telling us that you did a lot of hard work.
I did.
I'm sure you did, yes. Man, I'm sure you did, seriously. Talk to us again about just that experience, what you observe compared to what we're used to in the Caribbean, in terms of types, the quality of the place, the sport itself, the marketing, the logistics. Give us a first hand experience of that from your experience.
First of all, I was in awe at some of the things that I saw there. For instance, let's start with the stadium, the two stadiums, because we played the first and last game in Grenoble, and we played the second game in France. So the stadium, that's, you know, out of this world. The media center, we have the media tribune. Well, we have the national stadium.
We do have a media tribune,
right? That the level of organization and focus, and you go to games and you know that when a city is hosting, they actually tie everything into them hosting the sport, you know. So I was very fascinated by that. I was fascinated with the level of professionalism that existed with all the people that I had to interact with. TVJ are rights holders, and as a result, you have certain benefits with your accreditation, you know. So I was very impressed with that. I was impressed with how the FIFA officers that were on hand, how professional they were, you know, taking everything for granted, not taking anything for granted. Time was of the essence. I had to get to games 3 hours before the game started, because we had an interview with the coaches on arrival, and the coaches come in 2 hours before the game start. Those kinds of things, and it is clockwork, you know. So I was very impressed with that. I was also impressed with the fans. Jamaican fans don't cheer. They make noise when goals score, and then that's it. Them start chatting, them friend, and them argue what the better coach and top of idiot and what I'm do and those kinds of things. These fans, them cheer from whistle to whistle. They keep going at it nonstop, and I liked that. This is passion in football, and this is women's football, and these are passionate fans who have traveled from around the world to come and, you know, cheer on their team, you know. So that was incredible. The vibe in the stadium was amazing. You know, that again, they didn't take for granted that, just like we do, you know, we had somebody whipping up the crowd and all that. But there are things that they do to ensure that the crowd is making noise. You have a noise dolly that is good, that is being beamed around the stadium, and the more noise you make, the faster the dolly run and so on. Right. You know, so they put things in place to ensure that they have this atmosphere. That was incredible. Being in a stadium that is full and quiet is a different thing from being in a stadium that's full and noisy. So those are some of the things that I was really, really impressed with. And as I said, seeing the reggae girls walk out on the global stage was just everything.
And scoring.
Don't even bother talk about the and scoring part, because, well, first of all, in the stadium, I did forget about the journalist part. Me, I cheer for the reggae girls, okay? So I am busy cheering for the reggae girls. So when we're sitting in the media tribune with their other colleague journalists from Jamaica, my cameraman Andre Guthrie was sitting beside me, and when Havana Salon scored that goal, we lost it. And the Jamaican fans were just jumping up and down, and it was just incredible. I remember my Twitter page going, that was amazing, because at that point, every game that Jamaica played, obviously we had lost the two games prior to that, but we saw glimpses, we saw what these girls could do, you know, if they get the support and all of that. So everybody was like, please make them score a goal. Please, even if them lose, make them score a goal. People just wanted just one goal. Just not let the reggae girls have to come back home without a goal, because so many teams have gone to the World Cup and not get, so that was everything.
How does it feel knowing that you're the person from Jamaica and who's carrying this? You're taking all of this information from France. You're putting it in our living rooms and our smartphones and all the devices. How does it feel being that person, giving us all the information, what went into preparing to give us that information, knowing that people can always, you know, criticize or ask questions, etc.
Mixed feelings, humbling but also very happy. I remember when I was there doing an interview with Khadija Shaw, and I was asking her about, you know, being there at the World Cup and all of that, and in the middle of her responses she said TVJ is here so that people can see it. I was like, oh my god, Claire Grant has got to pay me for that, you know, kind of thing. So just knowing that, just when you talk to the girls and they tell you how grateful they are to the Jamaican people, because every time I talk to them I say, what would you like to say to Jamaica? And every single one of them said, thank you for the support, you know? So to be able to carry that, their feelings back to the Jamaican people, because in addition to the reports on the games, we had to do what we call memoirs from France. We were just walking on the road and so on. We had to interview the players and so on. So being able to capture that, and then being able, when you're walking through the streets of France and people are going, Jamaica, you know, Jamaica, anywhere we go, we're popular, you know? So I said, I tweeted one day that the reggae girls have made me one of the most popular journalists in the media center, because journalists from all over the world wanted to interview me, and I'm like, okay. That was new, you know. Right. So, and that was awesome. So it felt, I was happy to have been able to use this vehicle to bring the story of the reggae girls back to Jamaica.
One of the things that you had tweeted some time ago was that, certainly when you're dealing with track and field athletes, probably you talk to them before going on air, certainly to kind of prep them, etc. What are some of the preparations that went into, you know, some of these interviews that you did, some of these messages that you would be sending back home?
Okay, so for the interviews with the players, my assignment was personality interviews, because we had interviewed them about everything.
Yeah.
So what they wanted was a feature that they were going to show, personality interviews, more about you. So I would say to them, and some of the players are fine with being interviewed, some of them don't like to be interviewed, don't want to be interviewed. Some of them are shy or pretend to be shy, whatever. So I would say to them, okay, so this is a personality interview. This is where I'm going to ask you everything about your life. I'm going to ask you about your family. I'm going to ask you why you started playing football. What was the support like? I'm going to ask you, especially for those players who didn't grow up in Jamaica, I'm going to ask you, who are your parents? Because a lot of people will see players and them go, yeah, oh, she, but she white. Oh, does she qualify to play for Jamaica? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. So I would tell them that before, that I'm going to be asking you about your parents. So when I ask you about your parents, I want to know them name and where they grew up. But, and then when you listen to them, you realize that, for instance, Lawrence Silva, Roy Forrester is our grandfather, those kinds of things, you know. And some players, some of the players, their parents are fairly popular people in their communities, you know? So I would tell them about that. In terms of the memoirs, no, the memoirs just come upon you. So like I'm just walking through the street and I see this French man, fully white man, who say, Wagwan, Jamaica. Yeah. And I'm like, come here, come talk to me. What do you know about Wagwan? And he starts to tell me about living in Trenchtown and all of these things, because we are everywhere and people come here from Europe. You know, Europeans will just jump on a plane and come to the Caribbean and don't know nobody. Mm-hmm. But the memoirs, most of them literally just came upon them. I'm just walking through the street and in Grenoble ahead of the last game, and I buck up Jody Brown's parents, and I almost cried when I saw them, by the way, because they almost did make it there. They wanted help to get there to see their 17-year-old play, and they almost didn't get there, and it was the kindness of people around them, and they saw one match and they were going to go home because the money done and so, and the people like Pat Garrell and so on said, no man, you know, you can't go home, walk around with art.
It's kind of thing. From PLCU.
Yes, from PLCU. And let them see. And with those kinds of stories, it kind of give you a different view of Jamaicans, you know, how kind we are when we really, really want to be. And that was one of the things they said in the interview, that they just could not believe that people who them not even know were willing to put up their money to ensure that them watch them daughter play, you know. So those stories, I thought it was important that Jamaica hears, you know, the story behind who these players are. Because as I said, most if not all the players said that they wanted to play football. A couple of them parents used to play football, well, either parent. But several of them also, them just see the ball and start kick the ball and realize that they liked it, and their parents supported their dream. And I think that's one of the most important things that can come out of the Reggae Girls qualifying for the World Cup, that parents should support the dreams of their children.
Many persons don't know that you are actually an adjunct lecturer at the University of the West Indies, mm-hmm. right? You teach sports. What are some of the lessons from this experience that you'll be going back to some of these kids the next time you see them?
A different viewpoint on passion and doing what you believe in. Because in my first journey, you know, the first semester that I taught this course, I thought that a number of the students, they were doing it because, oh, I want one course where it says sports tonight, it's most easy. And then when they buck up in the real thing of what the course entails, they were a little, you know, taking it back and so on. But it's fine to do something that you think is easy, but also you need to be able to make the adjustment and quickly when you realize that it's not easy. Because that's kind of the journey of an athlete. You know, you might look at it and you love it and everything, but you have to work hard to be really, really good at it. And I think learning is like that. It is literally what you put in that you're going to get out of it. I mean, if you skylark and not go your lectures or not in your papers or miss your tutorials, then at the end of the semester, you're going to get a failing grade, you know. So it's literally what you put into it. So it's fine to be passionate about sports, but it's also hard work.
Now, talk to me about the journalism aspect of it. Now, in Jamaica, we criticize our media practitioners a lot for many different things. And sometimes we believe that one particular sport is not covered or women's sport is not covered as much. What do you think is your role in changing some of that perception about journalists, certainly in the Caribbean?
I think it's a big responsibility for us in media, because we criticize a lot. You know, we have 1,000 things to say about 1,000 things. So I don't think it is unfair that people put it back on us, you know. So that's fine. You know, as I said earlier, I have no issues with that, you know. So, and I take my responsibility as a journalist very, very seriously. And I want to tell the stories, and I want to tell both sides of the story. A lot of people will hit me up on social media and say, no, no, talk about it. And no, no, talk about it. When you put a mic in front of their mouth, they don't want to talk about it either. And I'm like, how am I going to tell the story if you don't tell me the story? You know, I can't just run with a line just because you say so. I can't just do it because you say so, you know. So I do take my role and responsibility as a journalist, as a woman, very, very seriously. But at the same time, I want our people to understand that our media is only as strong as you make us. Because when you have the stories, you have to be literally the ones to come out and say, do this story. People people criticize and say, no, investigative journalism now, go on and those. It's easier to do investigative journalism in big societies where nobody knows everybody, but when everybody knows where you live and people have genuine fears, you know? So that happens. But as I said, I take my responsibility as a journalist very, very seriously. I will do everything that I can to ensure that women's sport get the coverage that they deserve. I'm not going to ease up on the Jamaica Football Federation, for instance, as it relates to the National Women's League. That I believe that is, I feel like that's my cross to bear. I feel very, very strongly about it because I think that, you know, we have missed the boat in so many ways, you know. So that's one of my issues, and in terms of gender in sports, in terms of abuse in sports, things that as a woman you can push a lot more than the men would see. You know, my colleague Trishana McGowan did a wonderful series of stories where she talked about women having menstruation in period. Those are issues that a male reporter not going to write them stories. So you as a woman in sport, as a woman in media, as a female journalist, these are some of the stories that you can unearth, because those things are real, real issues. What abuse of, you know, coaches abusing their students, those kinds of things. Parents making themselves more responsible for what happens to their children. You know, just give up a picnic to somebody because them say them can't coach and them can't get them into X college. You know, to be there with their children, to know what going to ask questions. And if you don't know, ask. What that? Dalton Myers write one contract where say you're going to get 10% of what? What is? What does this entail, kind of thing? And ask questions.
I think that's part of this challenge that we have. Karen, if there's a little girl from West Kingston or from Mavis Bank, wherever, who's thinking about doing journalism, what would be your advice to that young 15, 16-year-old who is you know, just about to try and go get all those exams out of the way, then later go to university to do media, to get into journalism? What would be your advice to
her? I would cue chronics. Do it for the love, you know, do it for the likes. If you're doing it for the money, it's a no. Because as you can tell, many reporters have walked out of the newsroom and going to cushy corporate sector jobs. Mm. So if it's for that, then no. You know, I mean, obviously you can earn a living. You can pay your bills, you know, but you're not going to be rich out of it. But I would say follow your dreams. If this is what you really, really want to do, follow your dreams. You know, I believe very, very strongly that people should follow their dreams. And when you do what you love, it's not a cliche. When you do what you love, you never work a day. You really don't. You enjoy what you're doing. So when the sacrifices come, when the long hours come, because you have to work incredibly long hours. Even my assignment in France was long hours. Them did call me when it was 2 a.m. in France, because them never business, because it was 4 o'clock in Jamaica. Those kinds of things. So you have to be willing to make sacrifices, be willing to learn. Learn from the people who are there before. I know millennials think them know everything and everything, but no disrespect, you don't. And it's okay to not, because life is a journey, you know. So chase your dreams, learn, ask questions, read a book, come off of social media sometimes, because all the answers are not there. You know, read a book, research, you know, look at others who have done it before you, ask them how was their journey, kind of thing. But most importantly, follow your dreams.
What's next for Karen? What next for Karen Madden in terms of something new? I mean, you've had things, you're an author, you're doing so many different things. Living your dream. What next are you thinking about, especially after this experience?
This is a great question. I wish I knew the answer. As you know, I was thrust into teaching. I didn't go seeking out teaching. Yeah. Teaching sought me out. And I enjoyed it. The university has asked me back for next year. So I go back. I teach again. I think I probably should write more. My friends keep telling me that I must do my PhD. I'm not doing a PhD. No, I'm not. I don't want to study again. I'm sorry.
Why not?
Studying is hard. You know this.
I don't know this.
You know this. studying is hard. Studying is not what I want to do. I think I probably should write more. Definitely. I probably should write some papers, write about my journey, write about my experience. I want to write a book, and I probably should start doing that. But I'm not doing that. I have no interest in further, not lengthy study. Maybe I'll probably do, since I find that I enjoy teaching, the university has a wonderful short course that they do for people who didn't do don't have a teacher's diploma, I'll probably do that. It's probably about 2 or 3 months. I'll probably do that. I have no further ambitions where that is concerned.
Let me give you an advice, yes, though. Maybe you can also go around, you know, talking to clubs, talking to schools.
I want people to invite me to talk. Invite me to talk, because I'm not a social media influencer. It's only them get the talk. I would definitely talk.
Well, anybody who is listening to the podcast should invite you to come and talk to some girls, young boys also. Yeah. Why they should encourage girls to participate,
absolutely,
and their sisters, and nothing is wrong with it.
Absolutely. I will talk, because I like talking to young people. You know, I work with a lot of young people. They keep me young. Them give me all the young slangs and you know, bro god and them foolishness there. So, but I, yeah, definitely, that's something that I would do. If I'm invited, I would do that.
Amazing. Well, I'll send you the invoice for that one. Karen, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
I really
appreciate you stopping by.
Yes. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us this week on The Dry Phase. Make sure to visit our website coming up soon. You'll get that. Ensure that you subscribe to the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. That's where it's at now, so you never miss an episode. Remember, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Go tell a friend about the show so they too can spread the word. Feel free to send feedback, comments, questions, etc. to thedryphase@gmail.com, or look us up on Twitter and Facebook at The Dry Phase. Until next time, see you then.